From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to the home edition of The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Since my guest, writer-director Kevin Wilmot, was last here with his film CSA, Confederate States of America, still one of my bets for one of the best films of this century so far, he's going on to prove that early promise by becoming an Academy Award winner for his latest collaboration, or second-to-last collaboration with Spike Lee, Black Klansman of last year. My guest, again, Kevin Wilmot. His newest film is The 24th. Kevin, congratulations. Been a while since you big upped. Thank you for dropping by. Thank you for deigning to see us.
Oh, man, my pleasure, brother. Always great, man, to talk to you.
Oh, great to talk to you, too. And this new film, The 24th, let's just give a little context and say that in the year this movie takes place, there were five different race riots, and probably on the average a race riot every other year up until that point, because there were so many in any given year, it could basically average out to one a year. And I just got to wonder if that was one of the things that made you think this is something worth doing, because we think of race riots as being something from 60s and, right, and kind of the post-automotive revolution and a big city thing. And that wasn't always the case, was it?
No, not at all. I think that's a big misnomer that Americans need to know a lot more about to understand the racial climate we all kind of still live in today. I mean, that period between 1880 or so and almost 1930, I mean, race riots were a common affair. And I think it's that period that defines our life today probably more than even slavery does in many ways. Because the thing I think that's important to remember about slavery is that, you know, African Americans were worth a lot of money. And that's why the South didn't want to give up slavery, because, you know, they, you know, African Americans were worth a lot of money. But when slavery ends, then black life is, as we say now, didn't matter. And that's when you saw these race riots. And that's when the beginning of the problem with African Americans in policing begins. And that's, I think, kind of almost a hidden history. I mean, it's a very horrific period, that period I described from 1880 or so to almost 1930. And lynching and horrible crimes are commonplace in cities all through the North and the South. And that's that period that we try to deal with in the film.
I think what's really interesting about this film, too, is that it shows that the history of sort of black awareness really sort of dovetails into that period where you can't be a black person with some education, with the ability to read and having some sense of your worth, as you're saying, and not be upset about the kind of brutality that was commonplace. And again, to your point, the misconception or misperception, I should say, is that black people didn't really know how to stand up until the 60s or the 50s with the civil rights movement. And that's just not true. The fact is that there just wasn't the kind of coalition that we tend to think of now, was there?
That's exactly right. And you know, you got to remember, it was especially tough then, you know, as Dr. King and Malcolm X and all of them kind of acknowledged. I mean, black folks were outnumbered, and so if you were going to get into a fight with somebody, you're going to lose probably. And nonviolence ideas like that doesn't come along until, you know, the mid 20s, 30s. I mean, that's something that doesn't really develop ultimately until Gandhi gets there in the 40s, really. So people didn't know how to fight back. I mean, people, if you fought back the way you were supposed to fight back, the old good old American way of getting your rifle and fighting for the revolution that, you know, like a good patriot would do, you know, you're probably going to end up dead. And so that's the only idea, that's the only notion people had of how to fight back when people attacked you. And typically you would lose. African Americans fought back all the time during this period. I mean, people don't realize that part of the story, I think, nearly enough, that fighting back was part of what African-Americans, I mean, African-Americans fought back in Tulsa, and they fought back in all of those incidents. You know, they didn't just lay down and die. They tried to save themselves and others.
In North Carolina and Florida, there's so many instances of these black enclaves that fought back. But you used the word that I thought was really interesting and very telling about the 24th, which is you use the word patriot. And the idea of patriotism, which is in effect saying that I have these rights granted me by the Constitution, that's what makes you a patriot. As an American being born here, basically being able to claim those rights. And the 24th really deals with patriotism because it's set in the U.S. military in 1917. So if you would, let the audience know what the picture is about a little bit.
Sure, sure. Well, they sent a little over 700 black soldiers to Houston, Texas in 1917 to guard the construction of a thing called a camp called Camp Logan. And Camp Logan was designed to retrain soldiers to go fight in World War I in France. And the 24th, you know, infantry regiment was anxious to go fight in France because, you know, they were influenced by everything that was going on at the time. You know, over there, send the word over there. We all want to go fight in France. We all want to show our love of country and patriotism. The 24th had fought in the Spanish-American War, gone up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt, had fought in the Philippines. So they were, you know, a battle-ready regiment, ready to go and show what they could do. And it was a very racial war. It was the racial climate of this period. That's why we were talking about earlier. I mean, you just really can't underestimate how racist a period this is because, you know, Woodrow Wilson's president, he's a serious racist. He's just straight out serious racist. I mean, he gets up eating racism for breakfast, you know? And so he's, you know, he's basically doesn't want to send black troops to fight in France because he doesn't want to give them that glory, that respect, that chance to prove themselves. And so the soldiers, black soldiers, you know, the 24th was an all-black unit. It was segregated during that time, obviously. And so they show up in Houston and immediately run into friction with the citizens of Houston. You know, that old song that Leadbelly has called The Midnight Special, there's a line in that song where it says, if you ever go to Houston, you better walk right. You better not hustle. You better not fight. And he was referring to the bad policemen in Houston in that song. And the police in Houston at that time were notoriously bad apples. And they brutalized everybody, but they especially brutalized black folks. Long story short, they started brutalizing members of the 24th, and eventually a little over 150 soldiers marched on Houston and went after the police.
It's The Treatment, if you're just tuning in. Our guest is our old friend, and I love saying this, Academy Award winner, Kevin Willmott. His new film is director and co-writer with the star of the film, Trey Byers, is The 24th. And what I think is so interesting about this film is that you did a number of things to really sort of give it this epic impact, which is to take the character that Trey plays, Trey Byers, and to make him a modern man and a traveled man and an educated man. But unlike the kind of, when we see that kind of black man in movies generally, he is somebody who is not part of the race. He is somebody who thinks of himself as being better. And this character does not. And I want to talk to you about that because that's an interesting twist to give that kind of person. You know, that kind of guy who,
right,
is made fun of. I mean, be it Andre Brower in Glory or anything, when it's an educated black man, he's the kind of guy who says, well, I'm not black. And you made a point of making this character what would be called in that day a race man.
Yeah. You know, they did exist. And W.B. Du Bois is probably the best example of a character like that. I mean, he
absolutely
is educated overseas. He's educated in America, but he gets further education in Berlin, and comes back and he's the guy creates that whole term we really talk about. He's a race man, and he thinks race defines what it means to be a modern man at that time, and devotes his life to trying to really, you know, raise up the race and that whole concept of the talented 10th, you know, the talented 10% of black folks are going to reach back and help the 90% of black folks who are still in poverty and discrimination. nation, and that's what fuels, you know, Boston in the film. I mean, he is someone who has come up through that kind of teaching and that kind of influence, and, you know, and then he, of course, runs into the issues with that, which are, you're a rare figure when you're educated at that time, and you're especially a rare figure in the blue collar at best circles of the military. And so some people look at you as if you're a savior, and other people look at you as if you're a threat in some kind of way. And as you said, I mean, those kind of problems still kind of exist today within not just black circles, but American circles. I mean, education is not, you know, it causes a lot of people to be suspect. So that whole thing I thought was really interesting and honest. I think there were a lot more guys like Boston than we have seen in film, really.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And because the conception is in film or even in literature, we should expand it to that too. The idea of that person having awareness would make him sort of self-hating and tragic in some way. And you choose not to do that. I mean, the tragedy is he has to work that much harder to try to allay that kind of suspicion, right, that comes from people who are not educated and think that he reminds me of the kind of guy who, the light-skinned guy in the big house, who got to leave slavery behind and was treated better. And this character, Boston, who is nominally based on a real figure, is somebody who is a great pains to show that he has not left this kind of thing behind. And that feels to me almost like, as you worked on this project, this was really the crux of what you wanted to bring to the film, to show this kind of character wouldn't be self-hating.
Yeah, I mean, you know, guys like him, like Boston in the film, real guys like him that would have had the opportunity to get an education. Sure, some of them you could become self-hating and were Uncle Toms and things like that. But most of them knew that the education they received was rare and typically sacrificial, that people had to sacrifice to get you an education, and black folks had to sacrifice to get you an education. And that typically meant that you had a responsibility to pay back. And this time especially, African Americans are sacrificing, you know, on all kind of levels to really raise the race. That's why, you know, cities like Tulsa developed these great black communities that were later destroyed because, you know, people were sacrificing. People were very race conscious. They were trying to find a way to improve the lives of African Americans. And they felt that if we can get educated, if we can be industrious, if we can create an economy within the black community, you know, we'll raise up not just the individuals that benefit from all that, but will raise up the entire race and the community, and whites will see that and go, well, they're not so bad after all. Maybe they do deserve some equal rights, you know. And that was always the hope. I mean, that's what they always talked about. I mean, black soldiers, especially, you know, from, you know, the Civil War on, are thinking that their sacrifice will convince folks that they're okay and that they deserve better treatment and equal rights. And so that was just a huge push. And they, you know, black folks saw World War I as an opportunity to really do that.
Yeah, we will take a break. My guest, he's okay. We should give him the benefit of the doubt, is writer-director Kevin Wilmot, whose newest film as writer-director, a wonderful new film, by the way, is The 24th. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. This is Treatment. My guest, who apparently just had a really filling, balanced breakfast with all nine food groups, is writer-director Kevin Willmott, whose new film is a director and co-writer is The 24th, which is a look at a race riot in Houston involving the armed forces based on a real incident. And I do want to get back to this, though, because you use so many archetypes in the film that, you know, I can't watch it not think in some ways of you viewing this as a way to turn a lot of the ideas of what we've seen in films on their heads. And as a film scholar and film historian, it feels to me like in some ways your mission was to sort of introduce archetypes and then immediately make us ask questions about those archetypes. And that partially comes through from the casting. You have a great cast, Michael T. Williamson, Trey Byers, obviously, Bashir Salahuddin, and Asian Naomi King. But just taking that group of characters who, generally, when you see black characters, they get one dimension, right, and then they disappear, or they have the same dimension for the rest of the film. You guys go out of your way to sort of say, you think you know who these people are, you really don't.
I'm so glad you asked this, because, I mean, that's a big part of, I think, the next step that we should try to take in film in terms of these archetypes. I mean, the thing about archetypes is that, and stereotypes even to some small degree, is that they're true. I mean, like, black folks like chicken, but black folks like chicken because chicken was cheap and chicken was readily available. And so black folks took chicken and did a whole number on it. So it's like black folks just don't like chicken because they're black folks. There's reasons to make that connection. And in these archetypes, that's what you always see. It's like you've got the angry black guy in one of our characters, and he's attacks Boston in the beginning of the film. And Walker, could be argued, is the angry buck. But the reality of it is that, you know, he's got reasons to feel that way, and they're legitimate reasons. And oftentimes you see that story that, you know, between a dark-skinned black person and a lighter-skinned black person, and they end up, like, often killing each other in the film or something like that. And here they make peace because the problem that they have between each other is not racism between each other. It is the racist system that has taught them to hate each other and to have problems and conflict with each other. And that's the thing that I'm always interested in kind of showing, that these things that create stereotypes, that there's typically some reason behind that type that has made us think this and made white folks think that and made black folks even buy into it to some degree. And it is the exploration of looking into it a little deeper, and it's that complicated, you know, conflict of it all that always interests me.
I've got to say, too, this idea of, and there's something subtextual for those of us people of color in this country, that especially if you spent time in the South, you know that oftentimes the light-skinned people look down upon because they were thought as being, in effect, traitors anyway, being blamed for their own provenance, which they had nothing to do with. And by just casting the film the way you did, we can see those kinds of tensions between darker-skinned people and light-skinned people in the movie. I mean, that, in subtextual terms, is a really beautiful thing that you've done with the film, Kevin.
Oh, thank you, man. You know, I'm reminded of something I heard Dick Gregory say one time. You know that old adage about, you know, black folks are like crawdads, you know, and when they're trying to climb out of the bucket, they keep pulling each other down. And he always made the joke, you turn the heat off of that pot those crawdads are in, and they tend not to act that way so much. and that's really the point. Is like black on black crime, self hate, inner racism among color within the black community. Those things happen because of outside pressures. Those things happen because of systematic pressures, typically generated from the system of racism that we all have grown up in, that have infiltrated our minds and our culture and affected us in all these various ways.
What I think is interesting, and maybe it helps coming from an African-American filmmaker, is that you don't explain a lot of this stuff. You just leave it for people to, if you know it, fine. If not, you don't need to know it. I mean, you just, in narrative terms, this kind of abrasion creates tension that makes the movie move along. It gives it momentum. But if we know what's really going on, it gives the movie an extra layer of subtext. And I really have to think that this is something that in a lot of ways has been boiling up in you for a long time, because in films that are about race for you and not about race. You often deal with reaction to archetype and archetypal behavior and turning it on its head. And so the opportunity to have those two lines intersect must have been a real thrill for you.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I kind of feel that it's this period of our history, especially, that those archetypes are being constructed. This is when they're showing up in the history of cinema. You know, this is when Birth of a Nation is coming out, and it's establishing the five major stereotypes. Those stereotypes that are sold to America are then kind of sold back to Black folks. And then we kind of breathe that stuff in and then kind of start behaving accordingly in some cultural ways. You know, it seemed to me like this period especially is when Du Bois is trying to figure out, you know, sociology, and this is when the first ideas of Black folks living in cities and having to deal with systematic racism and constructed racism and segregation. You know, this is when it's starting to become real complicated to be Black in America. And folks are trying to figure it out. Folks are trying to do their best in terms of you know, saying, well, maybe we can do this, and maybe this is the best option, and maybe that's the best option. You know, you've got all these different kind of leaders who are suggesting different roads, you know, Du Bois and Booker T. Washington and Marcus Garvey and all these different folks. But more than anything, it just says that thing you're talking about, which is they were just trying to find an answer. I mean, they're just trying to find a way to make life better, day-to-day life better for folks. And that's kind of what I'm hoping to I hope we show in the film.
It's The Treatment. We're talking to our old friend, writer-director, Kevin Wilmot. I'm sorry, let me read the card right. Academy Award winner, Kevin Wilmot, his new film as writer-director. I'm so happy for you. I couldn't think of a better person, somebody who deserves this as much as you. His new film is The 24th. I have to ask you, too, about, because you collaborated with Trey Byers on the script, and I wonder how you guys met and how this ended up coming up, because like I'm saying, so many of the things you've done before, and even when you're not dealing with race in film, you're still dealing with archetype and the questions that film, the things we're talking about. If you're growing up seeing a certain kind of character, you greet that character as if you know him already, and in fact you don't. And so I was sort of wondering how this collaboration came about and how you guys met.
Sure. Well, Trey was one of my students at Kansas University. He was my screenwriting class. Yeah, he was in my screenwriting class. And he's been in several of my other films. And you know, when he was my student, I had an earlier form of the script. Oh. And I told him at that time, I said, man, I really think you would be great as the lead in this film. And so, you know, cut to like 20 years later, and he's become a big star on the TV show Empire. And actually, I was working on Black Klansman at the time, and we were trying to figure out something we could maybe work on together. And I told him, I've got this script that, you know, I wrote, you know, back in the day. Well, he knew about it because I told him about it back when he was a student. And I said, hey, man, you know, I want to update the romance, and I want to do a few other things. I just really kind of want to update it. And I just handed it off to him, and he took it and ran and came back and made a lot of the changes I wanted to make, and we continued to work on it, and that's how it became The 24th.
Have you had a chance to screen it in a theater anywhere? Because it's diminished by seeing it on a small screen, and just the way you staged the action, and it's a really sure hand, by the way, but you showed that you could run and gun with CSA, so you know how to do that, and make sure we know what's going on, and actually have action as commenting on the social context. And I just wondered if you had a chance to sort of screen it in a theater before we end up where we are now.
Yeah, I have not. It's actually playing now in Kansas City. And, you know, of course, any other time, but during a pandemic, I would have been over there doing a Q&A and you know, seen it 12 times or something, and I have not seen it over there yet. And so I'm hoping to go by and see, maybe have a special screening or something for it, just to bring my family or something over there. I mean, I'm a little paranoid. I'm 60, so I don't want to come down with that stuff. And you know, it really is. We worked very hard to make it a visual film. And, you know, I would love to see, have people see it in theaters. And it is playing in a few theaters, but most people are seeing it on their home television. I have to tell you that we shot the film in 18 days. It was a very fast shoot. And all my days of making all my low budget films have really helped me with this, because, you know, you have to kind of, you know, in those situations, you have to kind of edit in your head. I mean, you've got to, it's that's where the benefit comes from, writing the script and being very attuned to it, because you've got to truly know what it looked like before you shoot it, as you're shooting it.
Gosh, because it doesn't feel rushed at all. It feels really confident. And as we're talking about dealing with archetypes here, it's not just men either. I mean, we're talking about Asian Naomi King, and Boston looks upon her one way because he's an educated man and sees her as an accomplished pianist. And that idea is immediately kind of moved out of the way, literally, in the case of this movie.
Yeah.
And I want you to talk about that a little bit too, because it's just the entire movie, in addition to the narrative, I mean, this subtext is just sort of upending one stereotype after another. It just tickled me to death.
Well, you know, Asia's character is based on those women that during this period, there are few of them. There are not a whole lot of them, at least a lot of them that we know by name, that are, you know, jazz musicians. And they are learning the style and the approach, and are being influenced as African Americans have been influenced with ragtime and all of those things that are going on during this period. You know, she grows out of that, and of course she typically grows out of the church as well, like most folks learn the music at that time. And one of the things I really wanted to explore with her character was, you know, she's kind of she's sophisticated, but she's still also a down home girl as well. And she's kind of paid the price that a lot of women, you know, had to pay in a backwards society where women are not respected as they should be in various ways. And I don't want to give anything away, but I was interested in exploring that and how she kind of has overcome that on her own. I mean, she's a very kind of independent woman, and she's found a way to do her thing and to hold on to herself. And I was very interested in the relationship between her and Boston's character, Trey's character, in terms of this light skin, dark skin thing again. Because, you know, when you look at your relatives, you know, especially the ones that grew up in the South, and there's all that inner racism stuff that, you know, was always a part of Black life, but it didn't stop folks from getting together. You know, it didn't stop folks from light skinned folks marrying dark skinned folks, and you know, there's a whole lot of that going on. And you know, I just thought that was just kind of that part of that down home thing that I think Black folks, especially, kind of when they look at their past and their ancestry and where they've come from, I think you always see that.
I can't believe it, but we're out of time already. You've got to make another movie so you can come back and do this show again. It's been 15 years. My gosh, way too long.
I know, my friend. I know, man. Well, let's hope we'll do it real soon.
Okay. Thank you again for doing this, Kevin. Really, thank you.
Thank you, man.
My guest is Kevin Wilmot, writer-director of the film The 24th. Our recording engineer at KCRW is Paul Smith. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.